Well, it's certainly an honor. Wikipedia, very handy.
You can't how much of anything you
how
read
much of
stuff.
It's accurate? But I would say, and I'll bait the hook here. I heard Mike. I think it was a recent show. Wait, don't tell me. Was that recent?
That was
on
recent.
Tape.
Yeah, a month ago.
And he was a wonderful guest, and you know, it's just another aspect of his great communications. And he started with QVC, and I thought the QVC story, I just couldn't give it justice in repeating it. Yeah. So if you want to repeat it, be our guest. But you don't want to repeat it, you're not here for that purpose.
All right.
How much time do we have?
There's a guy named Bob, and when he gives me the hairy eyeball, I start running. So whatever you guys want to do.
Well, you know, just to give you some context, we have lots of ag economist type people speak at this meeting, and the same thing happens. They come in pictures, and I appreciate it because we were going to tell some story about somebody's 30th birthday, and her wish was to have a picture with you. And the truth is, it's about 6 months away.
Oh,
so,
well,
so.
No accounting for
tests. Okay, so we'll open up the floor. We have mics, so we can get all this for posterity. Please identify yourselves just out of courtesy so Mike knows who he's speaking with. Thank you very much. No introduction.
All right. Okay, thanks. Hello. How's it going? So many cameras, so many people. How do these things work? Am I supposed to say something pithy right off the top or just start answering questions? Yeah? Pithy or answer questions? Well, I tell you what. Let's go with the questions, and I'll insert pithiness into the answers, and through the magic of editing, you all will make me look smarter than I am. After the fact, that's a promise, right? That's good. Thank you. Yes, sir.
Mike Earl, Jeff Nally with the Cromwell Ag Radio Network in Illinois and Kentucky. I've heard you mention before the relationship and the need that we have for the soil, either for what comes from under it or for what we raise on top of it. How the dirty jobs and your relationship with the rural communities, how that helped to expand that story that you told before?
Well, it actually wasn't in that order. Dirty jobs, and I'll talk about this today in front of a few thousand people, I guess, but it really did evolve very much on its own. I didn't pitch the show that's on the air today with the intention or the knowledge, the expectation that it would be on the air today. This was a tribute to my granddad. There were 3 one-hour specials, and I just wanted to highlight people who weren't afraid to get dirty and weren't afraid to do this, that, or the other, or really whatever it took to pay the bills. Along the way, you know, I discovered a lot of things, some more obviously than others, but one was that every industry that we have that I can think of it depends on agriculture or mining. Every single thing we need, we either grow out of the dirt or we mine out of the earth. And what we do with that raw material after the fact, of course, you know, that's a business of farming, that's a business of craftsmanship, and that's really the one of the big underlying themes of dirty jobs. So your question was connecting with the dirt, I think, and that's really become one of the slogans of the show. Dirt is not the enemy. You know, work is certainly not the enemy, but the idea of getting dirty 40, 50, 60 years ago, everybody understood it. You know, farmers were the essence of our gross domestic product 100 years ago, so we loved our dirty farmers. And then tradesmen were the embodiment of our workforce, you know, 60, 50 years ago as the infrastructure was being built, you know, and so we loved our dirty tradesmen. Today, you know, our GDP is defined by something else altogether. We don't have a relationship with dirt. If there were such a thing as a dirt index, it'd be all wrong today because we're not connected to the people who are willing to get dirty. And that's really what the show aims to be. I mean, aside from a lighthearted look at work, that's what the theme is, to reconnect people in a lot of different ways with the fundamental notions of work, to learn a few things along the way, and to maybe have a few laughs as we do it. That's a longer answer than I meant to give you, but you got it, and I can't take it back. Yes, ma'am.
I'm Julie Harper with Brownfield Ag News.
Hi, Julie.
What is the dirtiest farm job you've ever done?
Well, I mean, you might as well just ask what the dirtiest job is because they're, you know, I mean, farming is such a huge part of the show. But I guess, I mean, anytime, let's see, there's a guy named Matt Freund. Matt has a dairy farm in, I want to say, New Canaan, Connecticut. This is maybe 4 years ago. But Matt, like maybe a lot of people who read and listen to what you guys do, was a farmer who realized that his intended purpose really wasn't allowing him to make ends meet as well as he would have liked. He was on the ropes, and he needed to supplement the milk that he was selling. And he figured out that if he took the manure from his cows, he could make them into these flower pots. This seemed crazy to me, but when I read about it, I thought, I got to meet Matt Freund. He's making poo pots, you know. And what he's doing is he's selling them so people can put their tulips or their geraniums in them, and they just bury the whole pot. And as the poop biodegrades, it's a natural fertilizer, of course. Anyhow, he's a crazy inventor, this guy, Matt. And when I met him, he had just patented the machine that allowed him to make these poop pots. And so we spent a day there going through the whole process. And out in the back, of course, he's got one of those ponds that I'm sure you guys have seen 1,000 times. But this really was Poop Creek, for real. I mean, it was a whole giant pond of just raw sewage. And, of course, I had to go out and paddle through there to get some stuff that was stuck in a drain or something. And I might have fallen in. And it was any day you swim through a lake of, you know, poop, even from your own species, you know, it's a journal entry. So I could give you 50 answers, but that's the one I'm going with. Matt Freund's poo pond behind his poo pot making dairy farm. It's a pretty good one. Yes, sir. Thank you.
Avery Davidson with the Louisiana This Week in Louisiana Agriculture. By my count, I think Louisiana is the state you visited most with the most dirty jobs. Is that correct?
Top three.
Okay, top three. What is it that makes Louisiana so darn dirty?
Well, I mean, it's desirably located, for one thing. It's a fun place for us to go. I think California is probably where we've done more dirty jobs, but not because it's the dirtiest place, just because I live there. Michigan's up there. But Louisiana became a good one for us because I think the first time we went down there, it was an exterminator. Guy named Bill Bretherton owned a company called Vexcon. And aside from being an unorthodox exterminator and showing us the sites, he knew everybody. And he gave us, the way the show works is we don't really produce it in a classical sense. We try and figure out one place to go, and then we go and we do that, and then we all impersonate reporters and try and figure out who's doing the dirty wherever. And Bill hooked us up, and those people. The thing that's different about Louisiana isn't the fact that there's so much dirt there. It's the fact that the people who have dirty jobs all seem to have some quiet little brotherhood, some club they go to, because they all know each other. And so we just got hooked up. You know, next thing I knew, I was in Cutoff with the alligators, Jerry Savoy's farm, and then I was back up in Shreveport, and then I was down in Lafayette to do something. And then there was an oil thing right there on the border of Louisiana and wherever we were. Oklahoma? Is Oklahoma border to Louisiana? Yeah, somewhere over there. Point is, people in Louisiana like to talk, and they gave us good leads, and that's why we keep going back. Dirty Jobs is programmed by the viewers. I should be clear. I haven't had an original idea since season one, so I go where the ideas are. Yes, sir.
Roger Ward from WLDS in Jacksonville, Illinois. On a different, more serious note, one of our main farm broadcasters isn't here, I don't think, has suggested he would like to see you as a spokesperson for American agriculture. Would you like to do that, and would you be interested?
Well, it's a tricky word. You know, on the one hand, I don't think American agriculture needs a spokesman. I think they need an advocate. And the advocates that I believe they need are people like me who have shown a long-term addiction to chewing and swallowing. I think the trick, if there is one today, is just to hit the reset button and remind people in 1,000 different ways of the amazingly gobsmacked task that you guys do day in and day out, which is feed 300 million people 3 times. It is so easy to become distracted by a lot of other agendas and a lot of other voices and a lot of angry acronyms that are out there. But all those conversations are fine. To me personally, I think it's a free country and people ought to be able to talk about whatever they want to talk about. But I do believe what ag needs is unity. I think that there are a couple of basic messages that the industry can get behind in a way that I haven't seen them get behind. But I can tell you, after doing the show for 7 years and working shoulder to shoulder with a lot of farmers, I hear the same thing everywhere I go. I've shot in every state, and I've worked on most types of farms with most farmers. And what I most hear is a sense that the rest of the country is just disconnected fundamentally from what it is farmers do today. We've just taken it for granted. And this is, if there's a message that needs to come back to over and over and over again, it's just reminding the 300 million people who rely on what farmers do that it's not happening by magic. There's not a steak tree in the backyard. There's not a, you know, I mean, it is extraordinary the extent to which we're disconnected from our energy, from our basic manufacturing base, and of course from our food, and from the people who provide it. So on a personal level, I'm a huge fan of all of that. On a professional level, I'm skeptical of the spokesperson relationship because I just see it over and over and over again. And I'm not shy about speaking. I represent some of the, I think, the best brands in the world. But your bias winds up showing when you go out there and start lecturing and preaching to people. And I don't want Dirty Jobs to ever be that. I want the show to be a series of examples that show farmers as they are, that show workers as they are, and that just quietly celebrates the business of getting the job done. There are a lot of ways to speak for Big Ag, but Dirty Jobs is in 180 countries. It aired 700 times last year. And the more opportunities I have just to show farmers being farmers, to me, that's the best way I can think of to move the needle. There are other ways, and I'm open to doing whatever I can for the industry on the whole. What I don't want to do, though, is be a predictable voice, and I don't want to create traditional materials because, in my opinion, the 300 million or so people that need to be persuaded aren't going to be by listening to the traditional sorts of messages. It's just white noise. So I do things like castrate lambs with my teeth because that's how they do it in Colorado, and that stimulates a huge conversation. And it gets a little controversial, but in the end, we get to examine really what happened and why, in fact, that was a really good thing to do. And we dispel some myths, and we give the farmer a chance to show us what he does day in and day out, rather than me the chance to tell you about it, like I'm a guy behind a podium, you know, proselytizing. It's not as persuasive as I wish it was. And again, that's a very long way of saying I'd be honored to help in any way I can, as long as I don't look like a traditional spokesman. Yes, sir.
Rick Trepter with Georgia Farm Bureau. You were down at a barbecue place, Fresh Air Barbecue, and you learned how to dump the old oil pit, the old grease pit. What'd you think?
It sounds familiar. Where was I again? I was in Georgia? What was it? Fresh Air Barbecue. Did I crawl inside the thing? Yeah, that was a terrible day, to be honest with you. I mean, we were on our way to the airport. It was one of those classic classic Dirty Jobs where we thought we were done, and there was a sign out that said something about best barbecue, whatever, and I thought, well, that can't be true. Is it really? And we went in and had a sandwich. It was good. And then, of course, you know, you talk to the owner, and he's got the barbecue, and it's a mess, and can I clean it for you? And, well, that's weird. And, yeah, I got a film crew, and we all went in, and it was just a very random day, but we learned everything about making barbecue and how the process works, and we had a few laughs. It's actually a great example of why the show works when it works, because there's no way you could have produced or, you know, no TV crew in the world is going to go to Georgia to do a retrospective on a barbecue. But we wound up spending 20 minutes in TV time shooting that thing in the better part of the day. To answer your question, yeah, it was miserable. I smelled like a chicken for about 3 days after that, I believe, but that's all right. I've smelled worse. Yeah.
You're also involved with Deadliest Catch. Are there similarities between the crab fisherman and American farmer?
Sure. Farmers and fishermen, miners, they're all basically the same people. Sit down and talk with them long enough, you know. The Deadliest Catch connection for me is a really important one because while it took me a long time to sell Dirty Jobs, very, very difficult pitch. And I got 3 hours of the show on the air. And while the network was trying to figure out if we would do more, they asked me if I would like to go to Alaska and work on a crab boat. And I said, yeah, that sounds interesting to me. We didn't know what the show was called. We didn't know what the show was. But I went up there and spent 6 weeks crabbing on the Bering Sea. I worked on a couple of different boats, worked a little bit as a greenhorn, but mostly as a host, you know, got to know the captains, went to 6 funerals in 6 weeks, and got a front row look at really one of the most demanding jobs in the world. And the last day I was up there, actually, on the Northwestern, I was on a satellite phone, and we wound up making the deal for Dirty Jobs. So when I came back, I was very excited because pretty sure I'm going to be in 2 shows, and I think both these shows are going to be good, and they're both going to be on Discovery Channel. And the president of the network said, yeah, here's the thing. You can't be in 2 shows at the same time. And I said, well, that's a bummer. You got to pick one. When in doubt, pick the one with your name in the title. But by that point, I had become very attached to Deadliest Catch, and when that show got ordered as well, I stayed on to narrate it. So I'm friends with the captains. I try and get up there once a year and work a little bit on the boats. But the shows themselves, yeah, they're very similar. You know, it's the same DNA. It's about regular people who wake up clean and come home dirty and have their own attitude about risk and their own notion about how the world ought to work. And a lot of that rubs off on you. I hope I'm better for it. But, yeah, good guys, a good show.
I'm Mitch Lease with the Capital Press in Salem, Oregon. Just want to find out about your some of your interesting Oregon experiences on Oregon farms.
My organs?
Oregon. So, no, I don't want to know about your Oregon experiences. The Oregon farms, do you have any interesting stories about Oregon farms?
Oh, the state?
State of Oregon.
In Oregon.
Yes.
I thought we were taking a really
weird
turn.
We're playing for the national championship tonight.
I got you. What did I do in Oregon? What's that? I was on a cranberry farm. That's right. That was, that was 2 years ago. That was a great one up in like Port Orford, maybe something like that. Yeah. Oregon coast. Great people. I also did a honeybee show in the first season of, do you call them honeybee farmers? Did you farm honey? Bee farmers, yeah, beekeepers. Got stung 14 times, and that was annoying, but good fun. But, the cranberry episode was another really good show for us because 99.9% of the people, just their entire experience with cranberries is those Ocean Spray commercials, you know, with the guys standing there just reading lines. But the business of getting cranberries harvested, you know, like any other crop, it's a son of a gun, you know, and it's time intensive and process heavy. It's cold, and it's weirdly good TV to see all that red stuff flying through the air and turning into jelly later on. I don't know if that's much of an answer, but cranberries in Oregon, you know, I didn't think we'd wind up doing that show in that state because I guess cranberries are better known in, you know, different places. But wherever, we'll go pretty much anywhere. Yeah, that was a good one. I forgot all about Oregon. Yeah.
A disconnect with our energy as well as our food. And I wanted to get your thoughts on ethanol and biodiesel.
Well, again, it's really, really important to never confuse me with an expert. I'm not one. And the minute I try to become one, I lose what little credibility I have. You know, the point of Dirty Jobs is to allow me to function as a fish out of water, more viewer than your typical Discovery voice of authority. And so, you know, my opinions on those things are what they are. However, my larger view is that most people have no idea what they are. And they want very much to feel good about the things they're told to feel good about. If it sounds like I'm talking in a circle, I guess maybe it's because I am. Let me tell you what I'm really impressed with. And in the same way we've lost sight of what you guys do day in and day out, I think the energy industry is kind of miraculous. And, you know, when I think about a gallon of crude that somehow becomes a gallon of high-test combustible fuel or diesel. I'm just amazed at first of all, how it happens, but doubly so by the fact that I talk to people every day who don't seem to care less about it. I mean, for a little bit more than a gallon of milk, you've got this gallon of fuel, and somehow or other, people are pulling it up from the earth, oftentimes, you know, in a mile deep of ocean water, and then they're doing things to it that allow it to explode and burn in our engines, which in turn allow us to fly to Atlanta in a snowstorm or drive home or bring the crop in. We're just not sufficiently impressed by the fundamental business of making energy. And we're not sufficiently impressed by the fundamental business of getting food on the table or manufacturing widgets. We just aren't. So I know it's not a specific answer because I don't want to be confused with a specific guy, but my thoughts on things like that are great. Great. Let's learn more about them. Let's see them. Let's innovate. But let's never do that outside of the context of being duly impressed by the underlying business of making energy, because it's awesome. Yeah.
I'm Mike Dana with This Week in Louisiana Agriculture. My producer, Avery Davidson, asked a question earlier. There's an old saying in television that the cheapest thing in television is the talent because the equipment is so expensive. I believe it was in Louisiana you lost $100,000 worth of cameras when that airboat turned over.
That is correct.
How much equipment do you guys go through in a season? How much does that cost you?
All of it, yeah. We go through a lot of equipment. You know, you mentioned Deadliest Catch. It's the same thing up there for the first couple of seasons. At the end of every episode, we just threw the cameras overboard, you know, because the salt gets in there. Once salt gets in, forget about it. But the good news is, I mean, $100,000 is a lot of money, but TV is a very lucrative business, and hit shows generate lots and lots of money. So if the cost of getting a show on the air, we just made it a line item, to be honest with you. We just said, look, this is... There are going to be costs. Some are going to be fixed. Some are going to be random. Some are going to be embarrassing and random. And when you're in the Atchafalaya Swamp taking a turn a little faster than you should and your producer steps over the line just a little bit and disturbs the axis on the boat and the front lip catches the water, the whole thing will flip over and everything on the boat will go into the water. And the only reason you saw that show was because... I happen to be on the boat in front of it, and I happen to have a camera. And one of the things on dirty jobs is, you know, if you work on the crew, you need to be able to shoot. Everybody needs to be able to do everything. So I wound up shooting the end of that show from my boat, and I'm holding the camera like this, talking to me. And of course, you know, you take that footage back, and at first people are just appalled by it. But because our show doesn't have a script and because we don't do second takes and because we don't rehearse or scout or really have storyboards or any of the kind of traditional things you do when you do a show, I'm able to say to the network, well, you know, that was kind of supposed to happen. And it looks exactly like it's supposed to look. And they go, oh, okay, well, that's great. And then we put it on the air and everybody's happy. So the bad news is, yeah, you hate to lose equipment. You know, it's a capital expense, and anybody that runs a farm knows that's a nightmare. It's not much different in TV. Difference is... we can put it on the air and people laugh when our stuff breaks. So, yeah.
I see your I'll Bite on the Safety Third shirt. And then also I'm thinking about probably your injury in terms of working on dirty jobs. I mean, farming is a dangerous occupation, to be honest. And I'm surprised that you haven't been injured more. I remember one that wasn't related to agriculture where you were reaching down on Lake Erie or someplace, grabbing snakes that were biting you on your hands.
Yeah.
That was a great,
Yeah, I'm glad you enjoyed that. That's good. Yeah, my dad calls it a revolving door of perpetual infirmary. No serious injuries, but, you know, lots of stitches, couple of breaks, you know, the normal stuff that happens in the course of working those kinds of jobs. Safety Third is one of those turns of phrase that evolved from the show, and I use it partly because it stimulates conversation, but mostly because I'm a huge fan of coming home in one piece at the end of the day. And you know, risk and farming and risk and any kind of work, you know, back to Deadliest Catch, it's a huge conversation. And what my crew and I found was, after about 200 or so dirty jobs, everywhere we went, factory floors, construction sites, farms, barns, wherever, all we saw the same thing, big banner that said safety first. And I sat through all of these compliance meetings, hundreds of them, mandatory meetings from everybody from NASA to wherever. And a funny thing happens when you hear safety first over and over and over and over again, you stop hearing it. You become complacent. It doesn't mean anything. It's just like the teacher in Charlie Brown, Miss Oathman, wah, 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 and you're just like, ah, okay. And I started to think, you know, every time my crew or I wound up getting hurt, it was just because we were in that complacent place. And I thought it's weird. Safety first isn't working as a slogan for us because we had heard it so much. And then I thought about it a little more, and I thought, well, is safety really first? I mean, what's really happening when we're telling people safety first, safety first, safety first? We're, in my opinion, creating this idea that somebody out there in the world cares more about my own well-being than I do. And once you buy into that basic premise, however well-intended, you mortgage your own personal responsibility, your own accountability. So to us, safety third means, look, if you want to come home in one piece, it's on you. And that real lesson, again, it happened on the Bering Sea. It happened with a crab boat captain. My first day up there, I was on a stack of crab pots, maybe 40 feet high. It was blowing 50. I don't even know. I'd say 30-foot seas easily. I was petrified. And I crawled down from this stack of pots, you know. If you're on a stack of crab pots looking down at the deck in seas like that, it's like you're standing up looking at the top of your shoe, only it's doing this. It's hazardous beyond sense. And I crawled down, and I went into the cabin, in the wheelhouse, and I said, "Captain, you got to be kidding me." And he's looking over his wheel, and green water's coming over the window. And he says, "Not now." And I said, "Not now. That's my point. You know, I'm like, OSHA?" And he says, "OSHA. Ocean." I'm like, "No, I get it. It's dangerous. But at what point do we stop? You know, I mean, it's dangerous out there. You know." And he says, "Son," he's my age, he calls me son, which I love. He says, "Son, I'm the captain of a crab boat. My job is not to get you home alive. My job is to get you home rich. You want to get home alive? That's on you." And I thought, man, first of all, that's crazy. You're never going to hear that in the lower 48. But a funny thing happened for the rest of the day on that boat. I walked around like this. You know, I made sure everything was dressed, the life preserver, everything. I'd never felt more present or accountable or aware of the hazards around me. And so after kicking around with my crew, we just said, you know what? When I say safety third to you, it means be careful for real because it's on you. So that's why that expression came about. And lots of other expressions like it have come from the show. I'll talk about a few today, actually. I'm glad you asked because I don't know what I'm going to talk about when I'm out there today. But safety third's a good one. So is brown before green. Yes, sir.
Mr. O, I'm curious, throughout all your experiences in American agriculture, what have you learned most about yourself through all your experiences?
Well, that's a 400-page book that I can't get around to writing. But mostly, I've learned that most of what I thought I knew was simply incorrect to varying degrees. You know, the Greeks call it peripeteia, that moment in a Greek tragedy where the hero realizes that everything he thought he knew was wrong, and that discovery changes not only the narrative but the direction of the story itself. Peripeteia, right? So I've had lots of those, and I'll talk about those today, but I've learned, I guess maybe the best example and the first platitude that I wanted to sort of debunk that was related to work happened when I was invited to speak at something called an efficiency symposium sponsored by some big company somewhere. And I was walking to the stage, and on the wall were these successories. You've seen them, right? Teamwork, guys rowing boats, go for it, rainbows, butterflies, bunch of bull crap. I hate them. And I was just like, whatever. I just can't believe people take these seriously. But the one I saw that incensed me was a picture of a construction site, guys working. And it was from the point of view of an executive in a corner office in a building that was already done. And he's in his suit, and he's got his arms crossed, and he's looking out the window at the work going on beneath him. And you can see at a glance what's happening. Here's a prosperous guy, seemingly smug, and here are a bunch of guys working in the drizzle, looking miserable, building a thing. And the caption says, "Work smart, not hard." And it was essentially some screwed up PR message to go to college. And it really hit me in that moment. We're sending such a bad, bad message, because I hear work smart, not hard all the time. And that's bull crap. It should say work smart and hard. And so that was the moment where I started looking at Dirty Jobs as an opportunity, not just to work on a show that people liked and have a few laughs and make my living, but to find people who work smart and hard and use them as examples to push this notion forward. And we've tried to, in our own style, debunk a great many of those successories over the years. But that was the first one, and to date, probably still the most important one. So, again, on a personal level, I come from farmers and fishermen. I've learned these lessons as a kid. I forgot them. You know, my business, I wound up singing in the opera. I wound up performing in all sorts of different places. I found out I went in a completely different way, and ultimately, it wasn't until I was 42 or 43 and the show started to work where I thought, you know something, it's the biggest lessons are the most fundamental ones. So let's do a show where we can champion hard work being performed by smart people. Because I had forgotten that, along with, I think, a lot of other people.
We have time for just one more question.
Okay. Make it interesting, for crying out loud. Yeah.
What do you do when you're not working?
That's funny. That's funny. I mean, on the one hand, I'm tempted to say I'm never not working, but on the other hand, to be honest, I'm really never working. I got what I wished for, or I got what I thought I wanted. It wasn't, but as it turned out, it was kind of better. And so, working on a show that allows me to come to places like this and answer questions like these is gratifying in a way that I can't really expect you to understand unless you've worked in Hollywood on a great many projects that you're deeply embarrassed of, which I've done over the years. So, you know, to have an opportunity to do a show that you produce, I'd say write, except there is no writing in it. But, you know, this was as close to an original idea as I've ever been able to implement. Truth is, I stole it from George Plimpton, but he was dead, and I didn't think anybody would mind. And, you know, there are no new ideas, but this was an idea that nobody else was doing 8 years ago. And to get it on the air in a truly unscripted way, and then to watch other shows come after it, I mean, and you've seen them. They're drilling for oil down here, they're fishing for crab over there, and to help usher in a whole genre of programs that celebrate work, you know, that's not work. And that's why I'll fly through the rain to come and talk to a bunch of farmers. That's not really work either. It's something I tell myself I wish I'd have done 20 years ago when I was a little younger and stronger and in better shape, but I probably would have blown it because I was an idiot back then. Not that I'm not an idiot now, but I'm a different sort of idiot, and I just feel very, very grateful for the chance to work on something that I'm sort of proud of. So, no, I'm always working, and I never am.
Thank you so much.
Sure. Thanks, guys.